Hi, and welcome to Pod Stallions, the official podcast of Plaid Stallions. I'm Brian, and with me as always is Jason.
Hi, everybody.
And today's episode is something so, I guess, entrenched in the 1970s, as it was a phenomenon, and if you were 5 years old at the time, like I was, it was all you thought about for a while before Star Wars, and that's the $6 Million Man.
Yeah.
The Bionic Man was probably the biggest TV superhero of the 70s until the Hulk came along, which oddly enough was another was produced by the same gentleman.
Can I just digress for a moment?
Okay, that's early.
Sorry. Are we really the official podcast of Plaid Stallions?
I think I can get that done.
Well, does that mean like I'm an employee of Plaid Stallions?
Well, yeah, but you probably
because
make as
I gotta
much
tell
as
you,
I do.
I've not been invited to one Christmas party.
We don't have them.
I've never gotten a company polo t-shirt or a polo shirt or t-shirt.
Yeah, we don't have a budget for that.
And, you know, you've never asked me to lunch.
Actually, I have had lunch with you in my car.
That's true. Yes. Stum.
Yeah.
Private conversation.
Sorry.
No, you did. You took me.
Actually,
to,
you paid. No,
what was the burger place called?
Licks.
One more time.
Yeah.
No, is that what it was called?
It was called Licks. Yeah.
Licks. We went for a lick burger.
Yeah, this is in my car. This is sounding like we're saying something else.
I know. It's like code for Craigslist.
Yeah.
Meet me in my van for a lick burger.
Yeah.
We had lick burger, and I had the onion rings as well, didn't I?
I think you did, yeah.
Yeah, and like a custom beverage, right? Like custom soda or something?
Yeah, I think I had a cherry Coke.
You had a cherry Coke. That's
again,
right.
We're still sounding
again,
like speaking
sounds
in code.
Filthy. This
yeah.
sounds absolutely filthy.
So, yes, this, we are the official podcast. I think,
all right.
I think I know the CEO, and I think he'll be okay with that.
All right. Well, I just want to make sure that it's okay for me to be part of this. If
we're
I'm
a huge organization.
An employee of...
Making hundreds and hundreds of dollars a year.
But I digress. Please, continue.
Okay. So, where was I? Oh, we were right at the start. So... You know, I was a little bit young for this, but I guess what happened was $6 Million Man was originally a novel, like a lot like The Night Stalker. It was a novel first.
It was called Cyborg.
Cyborg actually. Is by Martin Caden.
And yes, and it was, I think that for a while that was the working title of the show. But it was only a pilot, right?
It was a TV movie.
TV movie.
And I think Cyborg, I think the main difference between Cyborg and the $6 Million Man is, Caden wrote it more like along the lines of a man's novel. You know, it was science fiction, but it was kind of like the destroyer or the executioner in the fact that I think, if I'm not mistaken, he was an assassin.
Ooh.
It was a little bit James Bondy. And it really shows in the first two TV movies, and a lot like The Night Stalker, they both starred Darren McGavern. The first TV movie did not have an Oscar Goldman character. It was Darren McGavern was the lead, and it was a little bit more James Bond. And it even had kind of a James Bond theme song by Dusty Springfield. Have you heard that?
I have heard that, and
yeah.
It is very James Bond. First of all, you know who wrote it, right?
No, I don't.
It was written by Glenn Larson.
No kidding.
No, because he was part of. I think we talked about this on our Buck Rogers episode or whatever it was, the Glenn Larson episode. He was part of a, I forget the name of the band, but he was part of like a Beach Boys type band in the early 60s.
Yeah, okay, I do remember that. Yeah.
And they had a couple of moderate hits, and he was a musician. He was known as a songwriter, and so he did this theme. And when you know people are going to go run to listen to it now. Or maybe there's a link up that you've put up for it. It's very early 70s James Bond. And because I think if you look at those early ones, and I've watched them in the past couple of years because of Biff Bang Pow and the license and getting the DVDs and stuff, there's definitely a James Bond feel to it. When they launched it, I think they wanted like a TV version of Bond, you know, globe hopping and women and, you know, all that gadgets and stuff. You know, he had a, you know, Rudy was probably like the version of Q, and, you know, Oscar Goldman was probably like his M. And he was with that kind of theme. It was, you know, stank like Bond to high heaven. But that kind of went away.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, Glenn Larson was actually the producer of there was one TV movie that was a hit. They brought it back for two more, and yeah, Glenn Larson was the producer of those, and it definitely was it was a Bond flavor. And then when they got to series, they kind of got rid of that.
Yeah.
And the show, I think, you know, the show picked up its trademarks. It started to pick up its trademarks in the first season, and it's hard to believe, but the first early episodes don't have those trademark sound effects.
They slowly come in.
Yeah. I don't know. I should tell you what happened
to
me. I think
it's something different. The theme threw me initially, but then what I don't remember the sound effects, but go on.
I never do this.
Yes.
I never ask my parents for anything nerdy for Christmas.
Yes.
I would rather eat glass than ask my mom for an action figure, you know?
I would rather eat glass than ask my parents for anything.
Yeah, well, that's true. But one Christmas, a couple of years ago, Time Life was doing the box set, and it made sounds, and it had every episode and all these extras. Ooh. And it was like $250.
Jeez Louise.
And my parents had bought me absolutely nothing for Christmas, and my mother was really frustrated with me. And she said, you know, just pick something. And I picked that, and I don't think I paid for it. And I don't think I told her how much it cost. I think I gave her it was $100 or something, you know, just to basically she subsidized it. And I got that for Christmas. And I remember opening it and like shoving it under one of the kids' toys, like thanking her and then shoving it under one of the kids' toys at Christmas. And what I did was
so it makes sounds and stuff?
Oh yeah, it makes the Steve Austin A Man Barely Alive when you open it.
Wicked. Oh, wicked.
Which is not great at 2 a.m. when you're sneaking around the house. But
why haven't you given that to me?
Because I like it. And the other thing I started to do, because I don't watch a lot of TV, was I thought, I am going to watch this start to finish.
Oh, no, you're not.
And I am not going to skip to Bigfoot, Venus, Space Probe.
No, you're not.
And by, I say, midway through season two, I said, F this, and I was done, because it's episodic TV from the 70s.
It is when you do that, and I did it recently, well, a few years ago with Greatest American Hero. Which
oh, yeah.
81. But you forget.
How many pot boilers there are.
I mean, I'm becoming like a grandpa these days where some movies, you know, or animation is so video game like that I can't keep track of it.
Yeah.
And I realize that it's being done it's being done.
For the short
because
the attention spans
and the video game culture and all that stuff. I understand that. I'm not totally against it. But on the other hand, when you do that sort of thing and you say, okay, I'm going to take a 70s show and I'm going to zip right through it. I'll tell you the one that doesn't, and I know we're digressing again, is Rockford Files. Rockford Files moves. There is not a wasted moment in any of those episodes. Even when it's just him, you know, talking to his dad, and it's sort of related to the plot. It's so easy watching those guys, but it kind of moves that show. But I've done it with $6 Million Man, and I tried to do it with Greatest American Hero. The other thing too is you realize, boy, opening and closing credits of the 70s, they went on for like 8 minutes.
4 days, yeah.
Jeez, Greatest American Hero, it's the whole song.
The wife and I have been watching Game of Thrones recently. I'm like the last guy on the planet to work on watch Game of Thrones, but the opening credits on that show remind me of a 70s show. It's just like 4 days later. You know, you used to get an explanation of why Felix and Oscar live together, which I don't know if you need once you've seen one episode, but
without driving each other crazy.
Yes. But yeah, the $6 Million Man, it was hard to watch every episode.
Yeah, it's tough. Can I make you a little bit of trivia about that opening now that we're there?
Yes.
All right, so the opening, as everybody knows, is, you know, and like he's footage of, you know, him as an astronaut and this terrible thing that happens. She's breaking up.
It's a brilliant opening.
It's a great opening. It's a very cool opening. And then you hear a voice say, Steve Austin, A Man Barely Alive. And then a little bit after, as they're doing the surgery, you're seeing more of the opening, you hear another voice say, we can rebuild him. We have the technology, you know, better, stronger, faster, which I think has been sampled in loads of.
Oh my goodness! Yes.
Loads of music and techno songs and shit, but that second bit is Richard Anderson.
Yeah.
Oscar Goldman, who I had the good fortune of spending 10 minutes with at Comic-Con a couple years ago with our $6 Million Man stuff and our Oscar Goldman briefcase lunchbox, who we couldn't have been nicer. We mainly talked about Stanley Kubrick because he was in Path of the Glory, one of the greatest war movies, anti-war movies ever made.
Had to watch it in grade 10 history.
Did you see? You've seen it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's the best thing Kirk Douglas ever did, and it's a brilliant – it holds up so well, and it's so – pertinent, but anyway, we got talking. He's the voice that says we can rebuild him, yada yada. That's Oscar Goldman. But the voice that says Steve Austin,
it's more like Steve Austin,
a man. But the second bit is kind of throwaway. It's almost like he's like a man barely alive.
Yeah,
like it's just kind of but that is one of the producers, Harvey Bennett.
I was going to say Harve Bennett. I originally said Kenneth Johnson, but it was Harve Bennett on the $6 Million Man.
It's Harve Bennett, and he it's Harvey. It's Harvey, right? But they called him Harve. Is that right?
I can't remember. But yeah,
I think if you look at any of the Star Trek, the original cast movie DVDs, he's all over those. Because he's when you see him in those documentaries, you realize just how much he was a part of that series of films.
Yeah.
As a producer, but also as a creative, and it was his idea to go after to bring Khan back into that storyline because he spent a weekend. Exactly, he spent a weekend watching all of the original episodes, and the one that ended on a what if. It would be interesting to go back to that planet, say 100 years from now, and see what had grown from the seed you planted. He went up. Oh! Ding, 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 ding. There it is, Wrath of Khan.
Well, did you know that I just reading it here, that the head of Paramount showed Bennett the Star Trek The Motion Picture and asked him what he thought of it. He said, oh, it's boring.
He did?
Yeah.
Good for him.
Yeah. He said what we all thought.
It's true. And he from two on, I think he was instrumental in, and he shows up, I think, in five as like a Starfleet guy on camera. But he was instrumental in that. So he was one of the producers on $6 Million Man, also Glenn Larson, right? Didn't Glenn Larson do the original?
He just did the first TV movies, which were a little more. I want to say one thing about the show.
Yes,
it's a little buttoned down, but one thing it does that better than any 70s. Television hero with somebody with superpowers, and it takes itself very seriously. It never mugs. It never does a tongue-in-cheek. It's very serious. Now, mind you, if you look at it as a whole, OSI is the worst security organization. Like, every single episode, somebody says OSI is a turncoat. Like, they are just riddled with spies. But it really was. It did take itself very seriously. And some of the early episodes, in watching this, I did manage to digest most of the early episodes. And some of them are really cool. And there's one in particular I remember where basically there's a scientist and he's threatening this town with this device and he's in a van. And I think it basically ends with Steve Austin hucking a log at the van and blowing it up. Like, it's just a very, blap.
Let's talk about that because what made it very distinctive for to this day, but in playgrounds all over the world, was the bionic sound effect.
The whole
and then the notion of whatever he did when the bionics kicked in, they instead of speeding the film up and making it look like he just ran from there to there in a second, they would slow it down and they'd make the action sequences slow. So when you'd act it out in real life, that's how we play, like bop, 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 it's punching each other and stuff. But it was, where do you think that came from?
I know absolutely where that came
from. Where?
If you ever watched the Captain America TV movie with Reb Brown.
Watch it. I know it by heart.
Okay. Well, there's a scene at the start of it where he's running after a bad guy stole an old lady's purse. And of course,
oh, yeah,
only Captain America can solve this problem.
And he threw the shield at the guy's
throws
head.
Throws the shield, but he also chases another guy on a motorbike.
Yes.
And they chose to show, they use the special effects, you know, Captain America makes that, no. But he's running on the beach, and the tide is just going like crazy. Because
uh-huh.
They've sped him up. And, you know, it looks absolutely as bad as it sounds. It's Benny Hill. And I'm not a producer of Bionic Man. I can tell you right now, they probably took 1 minute of footage of that and went, this looks stupid. How do we do this?
Okay. So you think they originally said, let's speed it up so we know how fast this guy is.
And
it said it looked ridiculous, and they said, well, let's make it that he's so fast the human eye can't catch it, so we're slowing it down.
Well, if they slowed it down, exactly. You can catch it, and it makes it look more dramatic.
Do you think it had anything to do with the karate movies at the time that were all the rage?
Well, maybe Kung Fu might have been a bit of inspiration.
If they did slow-mo?
They had to slow down. They had to make David Carradine look fast, right?
Did I ever tell you the time that I was at a place called the Money Tree in Toluca Lake, which is a famous bar, and there was a guy called Paige Cavanaugh that used to play piano there?
Yeah.
And we'd go and drink, and you know, we all thought we were, you know, the Rat Pack, me and my buddies, because we could walk back to where we lived. And one night we were in there, and David Carradine was kind of in the corner, you know, by himself, and he had a drink like on a shelf, and he was doing Tai Chi.
Just
sort of off in the corner by himself. Just he was hammered, and he was like doing Tai Chi moves there in the bar.
I live in Toronto. I lived in Toronto in the mid-90s when Kung Fu: The Legend Continues was being filmed.
Oh yeah.
I have more David Carradine as hammered stories than I cared. Like I was at a Star Trek con and he was escorted out.
No.
Oh yeah, he had some bad years. I hear.
What the hell was he doing at Star Trek con? What's he got
well,
to do?
Well, because it was a local Star Trek convention, and they were filming Kung Fu right there.
Oh yeah,
so
like,
they bring the cast in to do a signing.
What are you doing Sunday? Yeah.
Yeah, and he was asked to leave. Now I understand that, you know, in his later years he had cleaned right up and that was good, but
well,
yeah, he was notorious in Toronto.
I only saw him one other time in L.A., and it was a really one of my favorite sightings. I think I might have told this story on the show. I don't know, but Musso and Frank is one of my favorite places.
The Carradine family, right?
The Carradine family. I took my brother there the very first time I took him there. We're waiting for our table in the bar, and I look over, and there's this table of a couple of guys, and then I see Robert Carradine and Keith Carradine. And I just as I'm telling my brother, hey, Jack, check it out. We turn around and David Carradine walks in, sneaks up behind Keith, like puts him in a headlock kind of thing. And we're seeing the Carradine brothers.
That's cool.
They're at Musso and Frank. Yeah.
Anyway.
Right.
Well, but you're right. I think the influence of Kung Fu.
If you're listening to the show, you know, you expect this sort of thing. It wouldn't be Pod Stallions without some digression. So we got
just call it digression.
So we kind of have an idea where that might have come from. But it's interesting because it was very popular. I mean, it was an incredibly popular show. Those fight sequences, the running and everything. So he had a bionic left eye. He had his right arm was bionic and his legs were bionic.
Absolutely, yep.
And that alone cost $6 million.
$6 million. Now, you know, you say slow motion might have also been very very helpful with TV censors about an abundance of violence too.
That's true.
And
do you think then? Because it was kind of ponderous and very serious. And I think that if you watch the first couple of TV movies, they're not happy-go-lucky. But
Caden's book's a bit dark like that, too.
But it very quickly caught on with kids and became – because this is where we're going to get into something really cool in just a minute. But it you know, when do you think that they found out that, oof, we got kids? Did they – set out to bring the kids in, or did that sort of happen? Do you think?
I think it happened naturally.
Yeah.
I can one of my earliest television memories, and I don't remember if it was one of the TV movies or what it was, but I remember one Saturday afternoon, a lot of TV stations in Canada would rerun primetime shows in weird slots on the weekend sometimes. And I just remember being sat in front of the TV, and the two things I watched was the premiere of Welcome Back, Kotter.
Welcome back.
And because I ran up to my mom and said, up your nose with a rubber hose and, you know, get off get off my case toilet face. I remember just being completely enamored and copying everything they said.
Get off my case toilet face?
Yeah. And but I remember watching an episode of The $6 Million Man as a kid. And it was probably I remember watching the first episode. I was in love. I just remember, like, I was bananas over this thing.
Sure.
And, you know, I understand from reading, there's a book about G.I. Joe out there. I think it's by Daryl DePriest, where he interviews the people at Hasbro. And one of the guys at Hasbro said, we got to throw a bucket of money on this $6 million man thing. Mm-hmm. And they said, no. Just make our own Bionic Man. Mm. And they chickened out at the last minute. They were going to use Bionic because there is no – you can't copyright Bionic.
Oh.
But they chickened out at the last minute, and they called it the Atomic Man. And Mike Power, the Atomic Man, sold really well until Kenner released the Bionic Man doll. You know that.
Well, now that you've opened that door,
we
might as well go there. Because this is significant to you, to a lot of people out there. It set a lot of things in motion. It really did something for a company called Kenner that did toys but wasn't necessarily mainly known for such things. So Kenner latches on, what was it, 75 or 76?
I think it's 75. In fact, I believe it's Christmas 75. And let me just –
Why don't you take it from here and tell us what happened?
Well – They got the rights. They very smartly – I've heard people say crazy things about the doll and you know, saying – well, you know, like you hear Bionic fans go, it's unusual that they use the red tracksuit to, you know, market this toy as he only used that. You know what?
Telling me, pal.
What are you going to do? Put him in a leisure suit?
Right.
You wanted an action figure that pops off the shelf.
Right.
You can't copyright Bionic. So you make it so that everything else is trademarked to the character.
Right.
You know, and you put his face on everything.
Right.
They not only did that, they could have probably just released an action figure and sold them like crazy. But instead, what they did is they threw every bell and whistle into this doll. You could see through his eye. You could roll up his skin. He had a lever to lift the was it the engine block first? I think it's the engine block first and then the girder
second.
Block.
Well, and the skin. Let's talk about that skin.
Yeah, that roll-up synthetic rubber skin.
The bane of many a childhood because
it's
difficult. Once you rolled it up, you couldn't get the thing back down again.
I had no problem.
And the pieces went – of course you didn't. The pieces went missing and everything. And let's be honest, that hole in his head wasn't that sexy. It was kind of cool to look through the back of his head, but from the front, you know, they never gave you like an alternate eye to put in the front. But, I mean, the point is everybody had it. We loved it, played with it until it fell apart. I remember getting a couple of model kits as well. We'll talk about those.
Yeah, those model kits.
The one with the gorilla is one of the greatest pieces of – box art in the history of merchandising.
The one I always used to see at variety stores in my teens was the one where he's kicking through a door.
Mm.
But there's also, I think, one where
he's drunk. He's trying to get to his
Yeah, date. There's one where him and Oscar are working on his legs, I think. Is that the Jamie Summers? I can't remember.
Is that a euphemism? Or are they really working
on like it? He's, you know, he's in his he's
Rudy's lab or something.
Rudy's lab, but Oscar's doing it cuz, you know.
I don't remember that. I remember the one with the gorilla, and I thought there was one with a bear. But
there's one where he's fighting a biker.
Oh, I never saw that.
Or at least it's on the side. There's one where he's fighting a gorilla. There's one where he's kicking through the wall. There by Fun Dimensions was his Kenner. Kenner must have
Fun Dimensions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's he's fighting a biker.
Is there a bear? Is there one with a bear?
No, it's an alligator.
Alligator, bear. I always get them mixed up in the wild when I'm out.
I'm just trying to think. Oh, and I'm thinking of the Bionic Woman got a model kit too, and it's Oscar fixing her leg in a lab.
Well, let's get to that. Now that's not like a euphemism. Hey,
yeah.
You're not in this show. Be quiet. Sorry, that was Henry trying to contribute. Let's get to that, because what happens is the show's on for a couple of years, and then there's an episode with Jamie Summers.
Yeah.
Who I think they're like, they knew each other, and then they're kind of hanging out again, they're dating again, whatever, and she gets into a horrible accident.
Yeah, don't they kill her off at first?
They do. She was dead by the end of the show, and that was it. But then it was so popular that they brought her back for her own series. And I think that they explained what happened to her or how she got out of it or whatever. I think they did do that in the when she returned. But she was dead. Yeah, she was gone.
I gotta admit, my sister loved The Bionic Woman.
Oh yeah.
I got no joy from it. It was a, you know, I
always thought she was kind of sexy as a kid.
Yeah, I was never smitten with her. She's a beautiful woman. She's still beautiful to this day, but it's
kind of a husky voice, you know.
She never hit those.
But I also like if you could pick an angel, Charlie's Angels, which one would you go with?
Jacqueline Smith.
Kate Jackson.
No.
I'm telling you.
Nobody picks Kate Jackson.
I know. I had a thing for Kate Jackson. There's just something about that voice and the cute little button nose. And I think we would have gotten along really well when I was a kid and she was a grown woman. But
yeah, that wouldn't have made the papers.
My letters went unanswered. So Jamie Summers then gets on the air. So they're on the same network, right? Or no, am I wrong?
No, I don't think they were.
I think
Steve Austin was on ABC, okay. And if I'm not mistaken, The Bionic Woman was on NBC. It may have been picked up. Let me think here. It was ABC at first, and then I think NBC picked it up. I am correct. NBC picked up for its last seasons.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting. That's really interesting.
That's rare. That happened a little bit.
Very rare that the creatives, because it was the same production team, I think, that worked on both those shows.
And because it's a spinoff of the novel,
right,
and not directly tied into Martin Caden,
right,
that's why you got a Bionic Woman television series a few years ago, a remake. But nobody's been able to do anything with Bionic Man because it was tied up in movie rights with another company.
It's funny you say that, because
you should know this.
Well, I know a bit of it, because for a long time, well, first of all, the Kenner stuff goes gangbusters. I mean, that was a very successful toy line, was it not?
You know what? It was, we kind of glossed over that a little bit. It was a phenomenon.
Right?
My mom has a story about getting the Steve Austin doll for me that she will not let go. And that's why I let her buy me that DVD for Christmas, because it kind of made her laugh. There was a store called Zeller's.
Uh-huh.
And they were advertising having the doll the first Christmas it came out. And she went, all right, I'll just go there when it opens.
Uh-huh.
And she showed up at the front door of Zeller's. And it was one of those old-timey stores that had the toys in the basement, you know, that kind of a – and she said there was a huge mob. And they opened the doors of Zeller's and let her in, and they all marched downstairs. And the guy's got them on the counter. He's like, ladies, I only have this many. Like, just right out of it. And she grabs one. She pays for it. And then she hears a click. And Zeller's had a street entrance as well.
Okay.
And she just heard – she said it was like a herd of frickin' elephants coming down those stairs. Like, you know, she just was smart enough to go in the mall entrance. But everybody else went in the street entrance. And she said she nearly got trampled. And the funny thing was, and I have pictures of me opening this at my grandmother's house.
Awesome.
My mom gave it to my grandmother to give to me for Christmas, but has never let me forget that she's the one who actually got it. Like, you know, once the Santa mystique was lifted. but yeah, it that thing was huge. Those toys are synonymous with Christmas, because they were kind of,
absolutely,
you know, they were $12 and $13 figures.
Yep.
You know, I could talk my mom into Amigo on a shopping trip.
Yeah.
I could talk into a rack toy on a grocery thing. But a $6 million man you got on Christmas and birthdays.
If you find them now, if you were to go out and try to, you know, get one, the packaging is huge. It's a huge figure. It's like 12, 13 inches tall. The box that Kenner did, you know, with the flap is huge and everything. And so they did, you know, they did loads of variants of Steve and accessory sets and
Austin. Yeah, well, the problem they had was the show was not very toyetic in its first couple of years.
Right.
You know, like most of the villains were guys in really bad suits.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, kids don't want a Michael Pataki figure. I don't know if Michael Pataki has been ever on the show, but I'm assuming yes.
Then you look at, like, Oscar, who was in every episode, hugely popular character, but, you know, they had to give him the briefcase because there was nothing for that figure to do.
Yeah, that briefcase put him right over the edge. They were really good at the gimmicks. And the most – my favorite villain of that series is – in the first season, there's an episode called, I think, Day of the Robot. And it's Steve's old buddy, Robot, gets replaced with a robot. And it's John Saxon.
Is it based on a true story?
It is. And John Saxon...
Who hasn't that happened to?
It's happened to me more times than I care to admit. It's ruined a lot of weddings. But it was a memorable episode. I think it's the first episode where Steve starts using sound effects, like when they're using it in the fight. It's also, you know, the first time Steve gets to fight somebody... super powered. And this I think brought along the trend of adding more science fiction to the show. And
well, what year, speaking of, when did we start to get, you know, and I should know this, but when did we start to get Fembot and Bigfoot and things like that?
I'd have to double check, but I'd say that was beyond the second season.
Okay.
What I was trying to say is the robot inspired Maskatron, which is one of the most clever toys of the 1970s.
So Maskatron, that was a villain that was made by Kenner, but that was not in the show, right?
No. Well, what happened was the first Christmas Steve Austin came out, there was no villain for him to fight. And Mego actually jumped on this with Montgomery Ward, and they created a doll called Dr. Chrome Dome, the bionic villain.
I know of him. Never got him.
The most thrown together... silliest toy that I had to own. And, you know, we should talk about bionic knockoffs because I own them all.
That's
too. The Dr. Chrome Dome is a silly looking, you know, recycled thing Mego did that they probably sold a bundle of because people would order it with Steve Austin in the catalog.
Right.
But then the next year, Kenner had to come up with a bad guy, and they chose this Day of the Robot, and they created Maskatron. And the features on this toy are amazing. He's got three masks, one that looks like vaguely like John Saxon, one that looks like Steve Austin, one that looks like Oscar Goldman. Okay. So even if you didn't have an Oscar Goldman doll, you did now. It has, of course, a suit, but underneath the suit, he has a robot body, complete with chest pieces. He's got a hatch in the back he can store his masks in. He has... a head that pops off if you hit, you know, karate chop him in the shoulder.
Yep.
He has detachable arms, and, you know, he's got like the Dalek suction cup and this huge claw. Wait,
this is all Maskatron, or
it's all Maskatron.
Wow, I didn't know
he is bells and whistles, man.
Wow.
Yeah, and you can really do that Monty Python Black Knight thing with him. Like you can just even in the TV commercial, Steve just decapitates him and crushes him. Like, what a great toy he was.
Yeah.
And I think if I had to choose my favorite thing they ever did, it would be Maskatron. Now, I did end up getting Bigfoot the next Christmas.
Until a little company called Biff Bang Pow got the license and they made stuff, and then that became your favorite stuff, right? Nope.
Maskatron's pretty cool, dude. No offense, I own all the Biff Bang Pow stuff.
We did a Fembot though. We made a Fembot.
It's on my desk.
That's what she said. Yep. So here's a funny story. So the Biff Bang Pow relationship, or my relationship with Universal Studio, sort of started, you know, right when we kicked the company off back in 2005. I've told this story before, but the first three licenses that I went after, the one that I was chasing for almost a year, you know, calling London every other day, talking to three different people, pushing about this, was a TV series called Space, that Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright and Jessica Stevenson and Nick Frost were all a part of. That never happened, of course. But in the meantime, I was calling King Features and Universal using that possibility as leverage because I had never done anything. There was no, you know, there was nothing that Biff Bang Pow had done, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'm going, well, yeah, but they're saying, well, what have you done? What's your track record? I'm saying, well, this hugely popular British series, I'm wrapping it up as we speak. You know, was it available on DVD in America? No. Have I ever seen it? No. No idea. But, you know, Shaun of the Dead. And so when I got to the Universal guy, he had recognition for Shaun of the Dead. And when I was asking about Lebowski, that opened that door. And he's like, well, we just wrapped up, you know, paperwork on Lebowski, so we know we can make merchandise. It was right at the time that Lebowski was getting to be a cult thing. And then once that all got cleared and we started these licenses actually started to happen, Universal, you know, would always call me and say, we got to meet about other stuff. This is so cool. You guys are doing this. What about these other things? And the two names, the two titles that kept popping up over and over and over again were Back to the Future and $6 Million Man. And even if it was every 6 months or whatever it was, they'd want to talk about these things and, you know, be a new person there and they'd pull out those names. Well, what about $6 Million Man? It's a huge thing for us and we love it. And each
nobody
time.
Nobody had touched that license since the 70s.
Well, the problem was for both of them, each time I talked to them, I'd say, okay, great. How are we doing on likeness rights, guys? Any word? Oh, no, we don't have Lee Majors likeness. But... And by the way, so everyone knows, we can finally clear this up. $6 Million Man and Bionic Woman, as you stated earlier, but just to reiterate, are separate licenses.
Yeah.
So, you know, Jamie Summers was not included in that license for $6 Million Man. But the reason that no one ever did anything was they never had likeness rights for Lee Majors or any of the cast until just recently when we finally got that license with Battlestar Galactica. It's like classic TV licenses. That was the first time a couple years ago when they finally got Lee Majors' likeness to be able to make stuff. But they'd want to talk about it all the time, and they didn't. You couldn't even. In fact, when we did get it, you know that famous, you know, logo with his portrait, and then the logo next to his or the name of the show right next to his face. It was like this. You know, it was almost like, wasn't it like a patch, like an iron-on patch kind of thing? Or
yeah, they definitely used it in different
Kenner
forms.
Packaging.
Yeah,
we couldn't use that. That was not that was like a copyrighted logo from someplace else that we couldn't use or something.
Jeez.
So we eventually got the license, and I you know, it's winding down kind of, but we finally brought to fruition some characters that never got their day back in the 70s, and you know, did some other cool stuff like some, you know, we did a reissue of the lunchbox from way back as a collectible tin with like some drinkware and things that we did, and we did Oscar's briefcase as a lunchbox that came with Rudy with three different heads. I mean, that was one of our. That's what I always point to when anybody says, "Do you ever talk to the fans or try to?" It's like, yeah. Here's a great example. When we announced it and everyone was talking about Rudy online, there were three different actors that played Rudy.
Yeah.
Martin Balsam, Alan Oppenheimer, better known as Ming the Merciless in the Filmation animated series, and Skeletor.
Eddie Deason was the third, I believe.
And Eddie Deason, and then Chuck Yeager was the other one, I think. I forget who the third one was. But so stuff like that. We made Rudy with three different heads, so you could swap them and shut up about it. It's been good. It's been fun to be able to do it. But wait, you just said something that was interesting. Here's my theory, because Steve Austin was an astronaut, if you don't remember.
I do.
Astronaut next to spy was a huge thing in the 60s for obvious reasons, because of the space race and getting to the moon and all that stuff. By the early 70s, mid-70s, it was starting to wane, but that would have been like that last cusp of astronaut coolness, right? Before the space shuttle started to kick in, would have been making Steve Austin an astronaut. I don't know if he was an astronaut in the book or not.
Yes, but I think he was.
I have a theory about astronauts.
Okay.
I'm going to get a little racy here, but I'll keep it family friendly. My theory is in the 60s, no one got more action than astronauts.
I've even known an astronaut to have his own genie.
See? That's what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, airline pilot, that's pretty cool. You know, fighter pilot, yeah, that's pretty
It's a real controversial thought that astronauts get laid.
Is it?
Yeah.
You're
a trendsetter.
I picture them with crew cuts and, you know, convertibles and smoking and, you know, drinking it, you know, when they get their day off and just walking into a room and every woman just falling over.
Nobody walks into a bar and lies about being a clerk at a hardware store.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Astronaut opens a lot of doors, let me tell you. I've done it. So the astronaut thing is big, you know. Merchandise is huge. You got Bionic Woman on another network, you know, hand in hand these guys. We got supervillains coming into it, like Fembot and Bigfoot.
I think those robots too were slightly, completely inspired by Westworld.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so too.
And I love that. I love that those Westworld type androids got everywhere. They got on Doctor Who. They got on A Man Called Sloan.
Did I tell you my Westworld story from Comic Con?
I don't know if you did on the show.
I'm at the Showtime because we have a great relationship with Showtime. Have done for years. We got Dexter. We did Weeds. Californication. Wait, did we do Weeds? I thought we did a Weeds bobblehead. Californication, or we were going to Weeds. But the relationship continues with Penny Dreadful, which I was very excited about.
Love it.
First thing about it, because it was right in the pocket of stuff that we do, and I feel like it could run for a while. It's got monsters and all kinds of Timothy Dalton, all kinds of fun stuff.
And it's just a happy, feel-good show.
It's a feel-good hit of the summer.
Yeah.
But the creator and writer of the series is a guy called John Logan, who did the screenplay for Skyfall. I think he won the Oscar for Gladiator, maybe. He's done a lot of really good stuff. He's done some stuff, but you know, this is really his baby, you know. And I was lucky enough to meet him, spend some time with him at Comic-Con, not just at the booth, but at the Penny Dreadful party the night before. And so we got to spend, you know, a good 10, 15 minutes. It was great because he's a big geek and, you know, we talked about lots of stuff. But once, you know, he knew who I was and he was telling me how excited he was about our action figures and merchandise and I can't wait to see him in person. And he's like, so you would be the guy that I would talk to about making toys for movies and stuff that I love that never got toys.
Okay.
And I said, well, maybe. And he goes, and I said, what's the top of your list? He said, Westworld. It's one of my favorite things of all time, and no one has ever made that Yul Brynner character from Westworld. And he's right. So the next day I ran out. No, I didn't get it.
Let's do this.
We should. Let's make it happen on the show.
Yeah. Well, let's make a Yul Brynner, and absolutely no one else.
Did you ever see? Well, then we went down my list of. I said, well, he goes, but no one would want it, would they? And I said, no. I said,
would buy a Yul Brynner right now.
I said, you haven't heard my list of of cult movies I'd love to have toys for someday.
Yeah, no, you know what I love about the Westworld is that Yul Brynner is basically playing the same character he is in The Magnificent Seven.
Yes, totally. I got a great Magnificent Seven story, too. You want to hear that real quick?
Sure.
Since we digress all the time. As you know, Magnificent Seven was Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen, Robert Vaughn, James Caan.
No, James Coburn.
I'm sorry, James Coburn, Nipsey Russell.
Yep.
Marjo Gortner. And
Freddie Prinze Jr.
Freddie Prinze Jr.
Yeah.
And Brother Theodore. We're all.
Of course, yes.
But here's the thing. It was 1960. Because Great Escape was 63, I think. So this was 60. Steve McQueen was pretty well known for Wanted, Dead or Alive, but he hadn't done a lot in the world in the way of movies. This was really his big thing, you know? So there's a scene. Yul Brynner was shorter than Steve McQueen. Not a tall guy. When they'd be on screen together, he would insist on a little mound of dirt being made by the prop guy so he could stand on it so he didn't look shorter than McQueen.
Mm-hmm.
McQueen knew about this, and just to F with them and make him more insecure, there's a scene where he's talking to the town or the people, whatever. It's, you know, from the knees up or the waist up kind of thing. McQueen just kind of walks over to where Brenner's standing and just starts kicking the dirt, just as if you were just kind of looking down and talking to a girl, you're bashful. But he's kicking at the mound of dirt. And it was his way of kind of giving the finger to Brenner, going, I'm better than you. I'm going to be bigger than you and more popular and whatever, and making fun of him having to build this mound of dirt.
Funny.
Yeah, that's my little want to hear my Towering Inferno story?
No, I don't.
So wait a second. Because you just were saying something about the toys, it was really interesting. So you would know this better. Okay. Wasn't $6 Million Man, and this is why it's so historic as a toy line, wasn't that – okay, Star Wars is going to hit. It hasn't come out yet. And they're talking, you know, Lucasfilm, Fox, whatever, 20th Century Fox, are talking to toy companies about getting the Star Wars license. And, of course, nobody picked it up because sci-fi hadn't done anything except for Planet of the Apes here and there.
I want to tell you this one thing about that, because it's a misnomer.
Okay.
I've obviously been involved in the MIGO Museum a long time and researching MIGO and talking to former MIGO employees, and people always say the one thing, they say MIGO went out of business because they didn't get Star Wars. Well, you don't go to business for something you don't have.
Right.
They went out of business for bad investments. Yeah. There's a number of reasons I could explain. I don't want to bore people with. But Star Wars, they rejected Star Wars because somebody junior in the company said no.
Right.
And because the president and the vice president of R&D were out of the country developing Micronauts.
Right.
They both told me, there's no way in hell we wouldn't have picked it up, because we were buying every science fiction license out there to protect the Micronauts. And MIGO has a ad that came out in the 77 that's basically science fiction, we have it. And it mentions Logan's Run, it mentions Flash Gordon, it mentions the Micronauts. And basically what he was trying to tell me is that if they had have been in, they would have just walked. The Lucasfilm representative walked in, they said, we'll take it. But somebody junior took it. And it's been rumored that it was Marty Abrams' father.
See, I had always heard that the reason people made that analogy was not that because they said no to Star Wars, that killed them. It was they said no to – so they didn't get Star Wars, but because of the success of Star Wars, they then wanted to pick up every sci-fi title they could.
They were already doing
it. Which was motion picture, Black Hole, Moonraker,
They never didn't pick up Star Trek, the motion picture. They had it.
Okay, so what I'm saying is, though – people, then this may be a misnomer as well, that in pushing for all of those other titles and picking up the other three, spending money on them, and they failed, that was their undoing. But that's not true either.
No, Buck Rogers actually was a hit. The Star Trek the Motion Picture was a bomb. Black Hole was a bomb. But they had much bigger problems in other areas. They were one of those companies that was overdeveloping on video games. And the video game, the handheld video game crash of the early 80s killed a lot of companies. But there's, you know, we'd have to do an Amigo episode. But I just wanted to go on. Kenner got Star Wars is what you were trying to get at. And if you look at the 78 Kenner catalog –
yeah,
that's when $6 Million Man, that's his last Christmas. And I think that it had to do with the series ending, but also I think it had to do that Kenner was just shoving money into Star Wars. You know?
Well, so my question was going to be, though, so wasn't when, and this is a huge, probably big freaking myth as well, but when the guys, when Kenner got Star Wars, when the movie came out, they only launched with, you know, some puzzles and a paint-by-numbers set markers and posters set kind of thing. There were no toys. As everyone knows, the early bird kit comes out for Christmas. But when they were talking about what they could do for figures and vehicles and stuff, they were pointing to $6 Million Man, going, well, look what a success this has been. Shouldn't we do something like this? Meaning, you know, 12-inch figures and stuff. And the other guy's like, yeah, but if we make vehicles – for them to go in. If these ships are as big as everyone's saying and popular and all this stuff, they'd be massive. So we've got to make them smaller. And that's where the smaller size came from. But Kenner was modeling it sort of on the success that they had with $6 Million Man, and that may have been the way it was going to go. But
actually, I think the bigger influence on Kenner's decision was the Fisher-Price Adventure people.
Yeah, those, because those were out. People forget that those
came out in 75.
Those were out and very healthy before Star Wars did. Star Wars was not the first 3¾-inch action figure line ever made.
I don't even think it was the sixth.
Yeah, no, you're right. Oh, interesting. Speaking of Star Wars, though, and a connection here that I was going to get to and I forgot, but now it's back in my head. If you look at some of the making of footage of Star Wars or making of, you know, photos and stuff, they used the Steve Austin doll. In like
the Landspeeder. Yep.
Yeah, so you'd have like Obi-Wan and Luke in there, you know, the model work they did with the Landspeeder. It's the Steve Austin.
Somewhere I have a Kenner pitch photo of the Man from Atlantis doll that they were proposing. They had the Man from Atlantis license as well.
Right. They make prototypes of figures and stuff.
They did, and they're beautiful. But they did, and I was, you know, when Frank Supiat was over at Super 7 talking about the Alien line, I kept joking with him about, you're going to do Man from Atlantis next, right?
That show's tough to get through.
Yes, ooh, it is. It's almost like they just didn't want to go on and, you know, please cancel us.
Yes,
brilliant, brilliant TV movies, but what a stinker.
As slow as we possibly can.
But what was I trying to say here is they used Steve Austin as the Man from Atlantis prototype as well. But, you know, I think Kenner had kind of run its course by 78 with the line. The only big addition in 78 is the Venus space probe, one of the more iconic and cool. Like when you count down Steve Austin villains, you've got Maskatron, Fembots, Bigfoot, and the Venus space probe. It is really neat. It was such an event episode. I've told this story on the blog before, but it aired, and my parents had turned off the TV for the summer.
Okay.
And my friend was also kicked out of the house.
Okay.
So we watched it in the windowsill of the basement windowsill of my neighbor's house. Like creeps.
You're getting your folks.
Yeah. I don't.
Summer.
And I've never seen it with sound until I watched it on DVD with my son, who loved it, by the way. He thought it was really great. He loved the Venus space probe. I would love to own that Kenner toy.
That's a big toy.
It's a big toy. I've always been kind of, you know, I've thrown bids at it on eBay, but it's sort of like the nerd equivalent of being pantsed and thrown around the gym. You know, I can't win that thing. And then once I got it, it is a commitment in size.
Yeah, and speaking of, this is something else that Steve got, Six Million Man got, that I, you know, you and I collect a lot of stuff, or we have in the past, or we're sort of semi-obsessed with certain things in certain ways. I had a thing about fan club kids for a while. Like when I was a kid, being in a fan club, I thought was the coolest. I mean, that was pre-internet. And I thought being in a fan club was like, you were really part of a club. Like, as a little kid in the Star Wars fan club, I carried around the ID card.
So
I had that.
You actually filled out the form and got it.
I filled out the form, got it, and I got my kit, and I got the little ID card with my force number was the name of your ID number for the club. You'd write that in with your name. I carried that in my wallet.
See,
I mean, I was 18, but
my
still.
Mom came running into my room and said, "Fill this out. You'll get the $6 million man kit." And I was like, "Oh, very interesting." And I opened my little desk and I put it in my desk and I said, "I'll do that later." And about 3 months later, I'm in grade school in the recess yard there, and a kid's showing another kid the cool $6 million man kit he got, and I was like, "Oh yeah!" And I didn't know that word at the time.
Well, I did. I'm almost positive I sent away for the Star Wars fan club kit, which was very brief because then it turned into, you know, the official Star Wars, whatever, and the new Empire Strikes Back kit came out. So for some reason, I did something wrong, or I must have, because I never got my Star Wars kit. Then I sent away for the Empire kit, and it took ages. I mean, when you're a little kid, if it says, like, 4 to 6 weeks, that's a lifetime. You're waiting by the mailbox every day. And I sent them a letter saying, "Dear Star Wars people, I haven't got my kit yet. I don't know why." And it must have been – I must have sent it off just as the original kit got sent. So then I got a duplicate one. So I got my original one, and then I got a second one for free. Of course, there was no one to tell, so, you know, I got two kits. But I'm almost positive I had the $6 million man kit, because I had – that came with like an iron-on patch, I think, and like a picture of Steve Austin.
I've got one right here.
Like a newsletter. Oh, you have it.
Somebody traded me. I don't remember what I traded for it, but I remember feeling like they were a sucker.
I'd love to get, because there was supposed to be a Battlestar Galactica fan club that I don't think ever happened, but and there was going to be a Blade Runner fan club.
There's a lot of those, like you join this, you know, the Logan's Run fan club, and you're like, really, yeah, did that ever happen?
In the back of the Lord of the Rings photo novel.
Yeah, that was the one I was thinking of.
The last page, there was a Lord of the Rings fan club, and it came with this and this and a newsletter and a poster, and the last thing it said was Lord of the Rings key fob, F-O-B. I had no idea what a key fob was. I asked my mother. She's like, it's a keychain, knucklehead. And I wanted that kit so bad, but I never got it. But I was really into fan club kits, and I'm almost positive I had that. Because it came in like a manila envelope, right? Not a box.
It's just an envelope. And, you know, if I had wanted to do show prep, and I, for this time we actually did do some show prep, I would have dug this out. Is it here? Nope. It's one of those things that I'm afraid to wreck, so I've hidden it somewhere. And I'm good at hiding things, and that means I'll never find it again. Is this it? This is it. It is beautiful. I will put this on the blog or on the show.
Oh yeah, awesome!
It's got a beautiful envelope that's got his face. Then it's got a certificate that says I am a member, not you, me. A really cool, like, I don't know if this is a sticker of Steve Austin breaking through a brick wall. Then it has an actual join the $6 million Man Bionic Action Club, which I think I am already in. But all right. It has another patch, a sticker that says $6 million Man. Then it has a laminated picture that says the number one toy in America, Kenner's greatest first year success ever, the $6 million Man. So it's a doll ad. And then it has a beautifully autographed kind of a 70s photo stat that says Colonel Steve Austin.
Yeah, it's like a fake autograph.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was big into autographs too. There was a kid down the street, Mark Bukulski. He had all the addresses. I don't know how he got them, but he had all the addresses. Anybody, you could ask him. Like my older brother Jack came back from seeing Alien and fell in love with a woman he called Signory Weaver.
Oh, her, yeah.
And he asked me to ask my buddy Mark Bukulski to get her address. And by God, he had the address to mail to her at Fox or whatever it was. And he sent her a letter that, you know, I'm madly in love with you. I saw your movie last night.
My uncle has like the cast of Laugh-In's autographs. Like, he has envelopes that say, you know, Laugh-In, NBC, and you open it up, and it's like Goldie Hawn and all the other people from Laugh-In, I can't remember.
I just came across, I have a whole three-ring binder filled with autographs from the time I was a kid to people I've met or people sent me stuff or whatever. And I recently rediscovered my Robin Williams autograph. It's a postcard of him as Mork autographed to my address as a kid, 1979. I mailed away for an autograph.
I have a beautiful thing from John Pertwee's publicist.
Oh, nice.
Probably from 1980 that just says John Pertwee, and it's a fake signature, but it's like a little postcard.
Remember the Doctor Who fan club, whatever it was. They found her in Australia.
Yeah,
and I sent away for her autograph, and like 6 weeks later, I got a nice little black and white picture autograph too. Anyway, so I had the kit, which you should give to me, by the way, if you don't want it anymore.
No, I didn't say that.
And I had some of the toys, and now we made toys. And
do you have any vintage toys?
Say again?
Do you have a collection of vintage, anything vintage from the $6 million Man?
I do not. I have nothing. I don't know where my stuff, my original stuff went, disappeared. I always wanted to just get the original figure again in the box someday.
I resisted all my toy collecting career because I used to see them all the time. Like, nobody wanted these things in the 80s.
Right.
And I used to say, oh, I'll get one later. And it wasn't until I bought that box set, and I think it was Christmas, and I got into the wine, and I watched the $6 million Man for hours and hours. And the next morning, I found an eBay receipt that I had bought a box $6 million Man.
Getting on eBay after a bender receipt.
Yep. And I've now bought every Christmas – I seem to buy myself one of these. And last Christmas, it was Oscar.
Unplug the damn computer at Christmas time.
No. I don't. I do them consciously now. I did it once.
Oh, sorry.
I'm not really good with wine, but it because these things remind me of Christmas.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
And you know, like, I don't buy the mintiest mint in box example of any of these,
right?
Because I don't care. And you know, I usually spend about $100 to $150 on these. But I have Steve, Oscar, and Mascatron.
Nice.
And occasionally I let the kids take them out of the box and fiddle with them. Not the Oscar. He's perfect. And I have the 3¾-inch Bigfoot and Steve on bikes.
Now, those were made by
Kenner.
Kenner.
Yeah,
what?
These are the Turbo Tower of Power, 3¾-inch figures.
Oh, wait. Are those articulated figures?
Somewhat. Steve's in a squatting position, so it looks like he has to go to the bathroom.
But, I remember seeing those, though, and going, oh, man, those would have been cool to have back then.
Yeah, we almost got 3¾-inch $6 million man, but I think because the show ended, we didn't get them.
Well, we eventually got a limited set, right, by blah, blah, blah.
Zyka? Yeah. And those are brilliant.
Nice, huh? Yeah.
I have those. He was trying to do a second set, and I don't think he got the pre-orders. I think it's really hard.
Yeah.
And I've noticed this because I go to toy shows and I bring Biff Bang Pow stuff to sell as well.
Uh-huh.
I sell Steve and Bigfoot all day long.
Yeah.
I don't sell Oscar and Fembot as much.
It's that when people, you know, we get into this, when people ask me questions about, you know, this and that, what works, what doesn't, and I always say, well, some of it, you can look in a crystal ball and go, I know that's going to work. You know, like when we had Doctor Who, you know, with the TARDIS, I just knew that the TARDIS was catching on in a way it never did when we grew up. That any iteration of the TARDIS you can in merchandise that you can do, people are going to dig. Then there's some things you just don't know. And some licenses I kind of always compare to Dexter. Dexter was this thing that it's his name, is the name of the show. He's the main character. He's in every freaking scene. And we could make Dexter till the cows come home. The Big Lebowski, you know, and Walter to a degree. But people would ask about, you know, the Jesus and Donnie, like, when are you going to make the... It took us a year and a half to get that paperwork done. And when they finally came out, they sold, but people weren't making a mad dash for them. It's weird. So something like, you know, the Dude or Dexter, they really become the focal point. And when it's an ensemble thing like a Battlestar Galactica or, you know, other things that we've done, people kind of want everything. But when it's a very specific character that kind of looms large in the title or over the whole... all the proceedings, it's weird. People kind of go, nope, I just want Steve. Oh, maybe I'll get Bigfoot, but that's it.
Yeah.
You know? And it becomes like the association becomes that red jumpsuit. Like we made an 8-inch version of Steve in the red jumpsuit with really cool little details like bionic leg and arm and stuff like that. And of course, there's a couple of people that jump online and go, he never wore this outfit in the show. Why do you always make it? But the thing was,
Geraldine?
It was Geraldine. Everybody looked at it and immediately had that recognition because of that red jumpsuit.
Well, you're playing to two audiences. You're playing to people that had that super fun toy and to fans of the show. But honestly, to the average person, that show is Bigfoot, Venus Space Probe, robots.
And those damn toys.
Yeah.
And everybody had that figure. So, of course, we would do that. But you learn pretty quickly that it really is the Steve Austin show.
Yeah.
It's like everybody wants Steve and they're not as concerned about getting, you know, other secondaries. So the show was very successful. I think it went from the original TV movies were like 74, I think.
73, I think it started.
73? And the show then ran, you know, proper to like 78.
78, and I from what I understand, 74 to 78, and from what I understand, Majors was done. It could have gone on. But, you know, maybe it was getting silly. Maybe he was feeling fatigued.
He's like, I got this great idea for a stuntman who goes out and collects bounties on people.
Yes.
I want to do this. And a couple years later, you get the Fall Guy. And a singing career.
And you got Raven. Actually, he made a terrible sci-fi movie in Canada called The Last Chase.
What year?
With, I think, 79 or 80.
Okay.
It's about the fuel crisis, and he's a rebel who runs off in a race car, and he takes Chris Makepeace with him, And
piece.
Yeah, whatever happened to Chris McPeace?
From Meatballs.
And he gets chased by Burgess Meredith in a fighter jet.
How much chasing could Burgess Meredith do?
It's a really dull film.
You know, he didn't. It's funny you say that because he didn't really have much in the way of a movie career.
The Norseman.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, that was in every video store.
He was in The Big Valley. You know, before he was. People forget that he was a pretty prominent face in television before that show. And of course, he was married to Farrah Fawcett Majors.
His first movie appearance. I just found this out. Somebody sent it to me.
Mm-hmm.
Clam Bake with Elvis.
Going to he's a just, clam bake.
Yeah, which I used to always make fun of as a teenager.
Yeah.
He's just in the background.
No kidding.
He was a friend of Elvis. Elvis threw him in the movie, and apparently he was supposed to be playing a bartender or something, and he smashed a whole bunch of stuff. So he wasn't even an effective extra.
And someone said, hey, that guy's almost bionic.
No, he's
a bit of a block of wood, but he had a successful TV thing in the 70s, and Fall Guy was successful for a few years, and he kind of disappears.
On a show called Raven in the early 90s. I remember it was in college, and it was jarring to see him out of shape.
Yeah, no, he was a pretty fit fella, for a long time, and he was a staple. You know, people loved him. There wasn't a lot going on there, but people loved him.
Well, he's very likable.
He was likable. So the show and Bionic Woman with Jamie Summers, they wrap up in 78. There was a bionic dog, right? Called
there was a bionic dog, a bionic boy.
What was he called?
I can't. You know what? I should know this.
Ishmael.
I think that's why my sister liked the Bionic Woman. Is she was very into animals, and there was a bionic dog on that show.
Right. So with bionic, everything was bionic, and everybody riffed on it. And then what happened was, the late 80s, as happened to a lot of things. Man from U.N.C.L.E. happened in early 80s. Other things, got...
We started mining TV properties and giving them movies, and some of them...
TV movies, yeah.
Some of them were good,
Return of the Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Return from U.N.C.L.E. is still fantastic.
Yeah, a little George Lazenby cameo in
the,
there.
The Get Smart one they did in 89, not the Nude Bomb, because that was wretched.
That's a classic.
The Get Smart Again in the late 80s was excellent.
Yep, I remember.
The Mayberry one was pretty good.
And, back to Rockford. Any chance I can talk about Rockford?
Like Rockford?
The TV movies in the mid-90s when they came back every now and then were pretty good updates of what he might be up to these days.
I think even in the 80s, Kojak was back on the air. Kung Fu got a movie.
So somebody said, they're all alive. They're all still working here and there. Let's get them back. Everybody came back. And actually the first or second one, I think, a young Sandra Bullock.
The second to last one.
She becomes the next Bionic Woman.
That is filmed in Hamilton. I actually know people who are in it.
Mm.
It's filmed at Cops Coliseum, the end sequences. And I think even one of the villains is a Canadian actor. They started filming them in Canada.
Well, they tried to... they tried to
spin it off,
but also these days it happens a lot where you go, oh look, The Equalizer's coming out as a movie or this and that. They tried updating Bionic Woman as a new TV series in 2007.
Yep,
with Michelle blah blah, British actress.
She's from Jekyll.
From Jekyll, and she was in a Doctor Who as well.
Yes.
And then Katie Sackhoff was in, I think, as the bad guy, but it only lasted like half a season. Didn't go anywhere. But
was that a writer's strike problem though?
I think it was it sucked problem. Maybe.
I watched it.
But the thing that's interesting is for years, there has been rumors of a $6 million man motion picture.
If you recall, Kevin Smith even had attachments to it.
He took a stab and he ended up, I think that comic book line came out with his storyline. And actually Alex Ross did the covers for that.
Something about that. I was trying to read that. I bought the first issue of it because I was intrigued. Because, Smith and the first thing was Steve took a big dump in the first couple of pages. And I just thought,
Kevin,
come on, dude.
You're so irreverent, Kevin.
Yeah, it's just something about that bugged me.
Jokes won't get old.
Yeah.
So that's never happened. And the thing that I had always heard, from like a decade ago, was that it was going to come back as a comedy. And it was going to be Jim Carrey.
Jim Carrey's been attached. Someone else has been attached recently.
But I think it's the kind of thing that Universal throws around every now and then saying, we still got this property. Why is no one doing something? And
I hate the idea of bringing it back as a comedy because you could make a really cool movie. You know, like, okay, Will Ferrell's doing Manimal, and I heard people out crying. Manimal was a dumb show, people.
Right.
But and it deserves to be a comedy. But $6 Million Man, to see it with a state-of-the-art special effects would be really neat.
Well, did you ever see the Land of the Lost movie?
Yes.
Jeez Louise.
I was, and you know what? I was 100% for making it a comedy.
They wanted
they
us.
They didn't, though. They it wasn't funny.
To get the license. They begged us.
You could sell Sleaze Stack dolls all day long.
But they wanted us to jump on as a full license with all the characters and all kinds of stuff that we're doing and this and that. I mean, they really wanted us I'll admit I had a couple of conversations, but I just kept thinking, this is not going to work. Like, this is, even if it kind of works, it's not going to work. But it's not going to work as just a complete piss take the whole time.
The trouble with it was, it wasn't funny.
It wasn't funny. And then they make, speaking of irreverent, they make Chaka like a sex fiend.
Yeah.
That's the whole joke with this guy, is that he's trying to hump everything. It's
if you put Will Ferrell and Danny McBride in a movie and it's not funny.
And there's no laughs.
It's
yeah.
like, it was weird because, like, there's so many things that I'm for, like, on paper. Like, when they made the Green Hornet a comedy, I was like, why not?
Yeah.
It wasn't very good.
No, it's terrible.
But I was on board. What I'm trying to say, I didn't walk into the Land of the Lost or Green Hornet going, this is going to suck, this is going to suck. I walked in going, I'm all for this.
You were
And then it's like, oh, no, this was a bad idea. You know, I agree with all the people who hated it the minute it was announced, you know.
That's like when stuff that we grew up with, when it does come back and it's done the right way or with a twinkle in its eye or whatever it is.
A bit of reverence, yeah.
Well, like for example, I mean, again, this isn't in my top 10 of all time, you know, comedies, but the Starsky and Hutch movie.
Yeah.
That Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson did. It was a funny movie and lots of great faces in there, goofy script. But it was violent and they were, you know, cool and everything, but it was kind of a piss take on the era and the things that happened and so on.
Yeah, I didn't hate it. I thought it was a little hit and miss, but that's a good example where they tried.
Right, and it worked, you know, and a nice little cameo at the end kind of thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, we should probably, are we at what, two and a half hours at this point? Where are we at?
37 minutes.
No, we're not. You're
actually,
lying.
We're at an hour and 15 minutes.
Okay, we should probably try to wrap it up.
Okay, well, let me go through this with you while we wrap up.
Yeah.
Name your favorite episodes of $6 Million Man.
I'll tell you what.
Even if it's the one with the...
Well, Don Saxon, I always thought was a great bad guy.
Met him 2 weeks ago.
Anytime. You did?
I did, and I was nervous.
Was he cool, or was he...
He's old.
Was he wearing a hairpiece?
No, he's about 81.
Really?
Yeah, he's a little. He looks a little bit.
Shit.
He looks a little bit like he's got some back problems. He did not converse with me very much, but he's a nice man. Like, you know, he didn't personalize his signature.
There's
was
just something
cheap.
About that face. That you I just felt go, you're never gonna be the romantic lead that's gonna get the girl and the hero and everything. You're made to be a bad guy.
Well,
he was a great bad guy.
He was a great bad guy. He's a storied veteran. And what really pissed me off is he had almost no line. You know, the guy who played the gas station attendant in the third episode of Walking Dead, you can't see him today, but John Saxon's got no line. So I kind of hung around.
Yeah.
I got him to autograph a Enter the Dragon picture, him and Jim Kelly, who I met Jim Kelly before he died. And then I started talking about Planet Earth, which is the Gene Roddenberry pilot he made in the early 70s.
Yeah.
And his assistant, he kind of went, huh? And then his assistant, assistant goes, I have a picture from that if you want to buy it. And I'm like, yes. And he had a picture of him as Dylan Hunt. And I said, I need this signed too. And, you know, John Saxon was really nice about it. I swear to God, he pointed to it and went, that's me. But,
Jesus.
And his wife, very lovely lady, handed my daughter a pen and said, for back to school, sweetie, because it was the day before back to school. And my daughter thanked her. And my daughter, as we were walking away, I was like, so does that pen say John Saxon?
John Saxon?
Or something? And she goes, I think it's just a big pen. And it was just a big pen. they wanted to give her a gift.
What you don't know is that Big Pen was used in Battle Beyond the Stars. Was he in Battle Beyond the Stars?
He was Sador.
He was. He was in Battle Beyond the Stars.
That's right.
So I think that one, and of course Bigfoot, because everybody saw.
Well, are you a Ted Cassidy Bigfoot? Well, there's several Bigfoot. Is it a Ted Cassidy Bigfoot, or was it Andre the Giant?
Andre the Giant with that hair.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a huge fan of Ted Cassidy. I'm a big guy actor fan. Dick Durock, the late Richard Kiel.
Richard Kiel, yeah.
So I'm more partial to Ted Cassidy, but Andre the Giant was, Kenner made a Ted Cassidy Bigfoot figure, and Biff Bang Pow made Andre the Giant, which I think is really cool.
That's right, we did. And speaking of Ted Cassidy and bringing it all back to Flash Gordon, do you know that in the original TV movie,
He was Thun
the Lyman in the Filmation animated TV movie, not in the TV series.
Because he died by that point.
Because he died, but his voice, he does Thun in the 2-hour movie that's never been released on DVD.
And you know what? He's also the voice of Brainiac on the old Challenge of the Super Friends cartoon.
That's right. What a voice!
He was a radio guy. No, believe it or not. My two favorites are, one is the Venus Space Probe episode, just because of the what I had to do to see it. And two, there's an episode called The Island. It's a two-parter where there's a secret society living under a force field of aliens.
Uh-huh.
And a satellite crashes on the island, starts turning half of them into mutants. And Steve...
Also a true story, I think.
It's based on a true story. Steve is brought in to fight the mutants.
Yes.
And save the island. And I think his bionics break down or something. But I just remember thinking that was... it's very science fiction. It may have been the last season or the second to last season of the show. But it was... the one that was killing me to see again, because I hadn't seen it since I was a kid. And it's an interesting story, and it's one of my favorites.
Speaking of bionic breakdown, and this is a good way to wrap it up.
Okay.
I've met Richard Anderson, but I never met Lee Majors, but I have a friend who's been out here in LA probably as long as I have. So a good, 15, 20 years ago, he had a great sighting, which was Lee Majors and Richard Anderson at a bar. And I guess Lee Majors had a few too many, and as they paid their tab and tried to walk away from the bar, Majors was stumbling all over the place, and Richard Anderson kind of propped him up and walked him out of the bar, and I said, oh my god, a bionic breakdown. I would have given anything to have seen that. Oscar Goldman,
I would have loved to buy them a beer. That would have been cool,
helping Steve Austin out of the bar, because the
If I can dig it out of my archives, I have a Lee Majors trying to lose weight commercial from the early 80s. I don't know if it's for Tab or Shasta, but it's really horrible.
Please put that up.
I will try and find it and upload it to the Facebook page.
He also had a great cameo in Scrooged, one of my favorite holiday movies.
Right, that's brilliant.
He's the $6 million man. He shows up to save Santa's it's called the Night the Reindeer Died or something like that.
Yeah, I forgot all about that. And
Murray tries to get going. He's in that. That's the last thing I think I've ever seen him in. He was possibly going to be at our booth at Comic-Con.
Oh, really?
2 years ago. Yeah, or a year and a half ago. But I think he wanted like $1.5 million to appear for like 2 hours.
That's a quarter of him.
Yeah. So, he thought, no, that's okay. Thank you, though.
Well, a few years ago he showed up at Canada's version of Comic-Con, and the thing, we went this year and I'll never go back again because it's just market day in Bangladesh and I don't like crowds. And he showed up, and luckily a friend of mine, Ed, who's listening, hi Ed, he was a vendor at that show. He does really great. He can survive that crowd. And I just basically texted him while my kid was playing soccer and said, hey, get me Lee Majors' autograph if you have time. So I have Lee Majors' autograph, but I've never met the man.
Well, that's, I have Mark Hamill's autograph.
Neat.
I've met him separately.
We share a birthday.
But I have Mark Hamill's autograph, though I never met him to get the autograph.
Yeah, I have a couple like that where it's just – there was one show I went to where the line for one of the actors was so long, I just bought his autograph at a table. The show, I was like, ah, I'll just get this, you know.
That's funny. Yeah. You know what it is? You know, it's funny though. I can so this will bring it around as well. That's 100 years ago out here in L.A. and it was some show, and Huckabone was there. Mark Huckabone was there.
Ooh.
And he had a table, he had a booth, and he you know wanted me to help him with the booth, and I did because I got into the show for free for a couple of days. It was
that
a big
familiar.
Show, whatever this thing was. And the first day, this third or fourth friend or whatever it was going to wait in line for Mark Hamill, and I said, "Here's you know $20-$30, whatever it is. Will you grab me a picture, and will you please get my you know to Jason? It'd be great because I have a lot of to Jason stuff, and that way I'll never get rid of it, sort of thing."
Yeah, I love personalizing and stuff.
And he comes back like 4 hours later, and I remember the look on this guy's face. He went, "I'm so sorry." I went, what happened? It didn't work out?" He goes, "No, it did." But and he hands me the picture, and it says, "To Patrick, best wishes, Mark Hamill." And I looked up. I said, "What happened?" And he goes, "I said to him, can you make this one to Jason? You know, to Jason, it's for my friend." He goes, "Sure, you got it." And then the next thing I know, I pick it up and it says, "To Patrick, best wishes, Mark Hamill." So the next day, I had the guy go back and do it again. And then this time I got one to Jason.
So did you give that?
But it was, but unfortunately, it was a picture of Robert Wagner.
Oh, damn it.
I'm kidding. No, that's kind of funny. Anyway, there's a Bionic story right there for you.
Yeah.
I mean, where else are you going to get these kinds of stories?
Huh? And I think what we'll do on the Pod Stallions Facebook page is I'll put up a potpourri of merchandise, including some of my favorite Bionic Man knockoffs. You know, everybody from Big Jim to G.I. Joe to the
the one you've got with the Tomland, right? Is it Tomland?
The Tomland Sonic Man and Sonic Woman.
Yeah, those are classic.
Those are classically bad. The French Android Man, who has a Planet of the Apes Maskatron face, a G.I. Joe one.
I kind of like to think, you know, remember when we were kids, when you didn't get figures or toys from certain movies, you took other stuff that you had and pretended it came from that movie or whatever?
Oh, sure, yeah.
So I like to pretend sometimes that the Steve Austin and Bigfoot that we did are the same ones that are in the Venture Brothers. That first season of Venture Brothers, remember when he shows up?
I think he shows up in more than one episode, but yeah.
Yeah.
One of the greatest lines ever was he shaves Bigfoot and he says, "You know, you could have told me Bigfoot was a dude." And he says, and Steve Austin says, "He's got nothing you haven't seen before." And he says, "Bigfoot is something I've never seen before."
Yeah, that's right. So I like to pretend that the 8-inch you know, retro figures we made for Venture Brothers that you know, the Steve Austin and Bigfoot we did could kind of hang with them. They're all part of the same show.
And, yeah, of course, because Brock Sampson works for OSI. But I also have the 8-inch Peruvian Steve Austin.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I remember seeing that.
Yeah.
That's cool. You got to put all that stuff up.
I will. I guess I like Bionic toys more than I thought.
I guess you do.
All right. Oh, by the way, I broke my Biff Bang Pow coffee mug this morning, or this Monday.
Which coffee mug?
The $6 million man one.
You did?
In the car. It was a treat. Luckily, nothing.
When it broke, did it go?
No, but I didn't get coffee on my crotch, so that was good. Thank you.
You have those keychains, right? The exclusive keychains we did.
I think my family's hidden them from me.
Well, I've got more somewhere, so I'll send you more.
All right.
There you go, people. Hope you enjoyed that.
Thanks very much, guys. We're going to go run in slow motion now.
More gold coming in the next 4 to 6 weeks.
Yep. We're going to probably do 2 Halloween episodes again this year.
Yeah.
If you have ideas for a Halloween episode, let us know.
Please send them along.
Okay.
Love it.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.